listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people. Hello everyone, I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Monica Melanchthon.
And this week, Monica and I will be discussing the readings for the 8th week after Pentecost, focusing particularly on Hosea 11, verses 1 to 11, and Luke 12, verses 13 to 21. But I think we may also make brief mention of the Psalm, which is 107, and of Colossians chapter 3, 1 to 11. We'll see how we go. So, Monica, let's kick off with Hosea chapter 11.
Yes. Thank you, Fran. As many of you may have heard last week, you know, we began with the Hosea reading, and you may have been given a little bit of information about the background of Hosea. It's important to recognize that Hosea was prophesying during some very turbulent years of the Northern Kingdom. It was a period which was characterized by a lot of conflict and war with neighboring nations. And one of the key historical events that the book has to be understood against is the Syro-Ephraimite War, which was a war between Israel, that is northern Israel, and Syria against Assyria, and they had hoped they wanted to bring Judah into this coalition, but Judah refused. And anyway, this led to the downfall of Damascus and eventually Samaria as well. And it is not certain whether Hosea witnessed the fall of Samaria in 722-21 BCE, but we do know that that he was prophesying in the years leading up to the fall of Samaria.
So, time of huge upheaval.
A lot of upheaval.
And as we did discuss last week, his concern is the idolatry of Israel, confusing Yahweh with the Baal gods, and also thinking it's Israel's future lay in kings, having a strong enough king, or as you say, a sufficient military force,
right?
And in the process, trampling on the poor.
Yes, yes. It was, I think the book needs to be understood against and within this history of catastrophes.
Yes.
That confronted the nation. But the period was also one in which there were unhealthy political alliances made with some of the neighboring nations, and this was paralleled with their interest and loyalty to the Canaanite fertility cults.
Right, yes.
Okay, so the people apparently did not see Yahweh as one who provides material or security, material goods or security for the nation. They saw no connection between their economic success and what they thought to be sacrifice and worship of Yahweh. And as one scholar says, Israel Baalized Yahweh. Okay, so, and many passages, therefore, in the book refer to this prostitution.
Yes.
And Hosea is perhaps most well known to readers as the prophet who uses the marriage metaphor to address this issue of prostitution.
Yes.
And prostitution here understood as worship of other gods and participation in the Canaanite fertility cults. So Hosea's words of judgment are centered on the activities which the people thought were correct, or at least permissible actions of faith. And the prophet is saying, no, this is not what is required of you. This is not what is good.
What God requires of you is mercy.
Yes.
And not burnt offerings, and indeed steadfast love, which is said in chapter 6, I think, which is something that bears out in today's passage.
Yes, yes, yes. So Hosea 11 is a very interesting passage. First of all, it's made up of four distinct sections. So you have verses 1 to 4, where the emphasis is on the beginnings of Israel in the love and the call of Yahweh, strongly based on the Exodus tradition. And there is a parallel made between the disobedience of Israel and Yahweh's love. And the metaphor used here is of parental love. And one can understand it as either a father's love or a mother's love, but let's go with parental.
Parent, yeah. I'm very struck by the intimacy of the imagery here. It's and the sort of devotion of God to God's people, calling them, teaching them to walk, lifting them up in his arms, touching their cheek, you know, picking up the baby to touch God's cheek, bending down to feed them. It's incredibly active and accommodating.
Right. Yes, and so I think it's also good to recognize the fact that the speaking voice here is Yahweh, mm-hmm. A God in the entire section, and in these first four and in the entire chapter, what one can see is a lot of emotion and grief being expressed by God, and so therefore this is an emotion filled, grief stricken, I voice poem. Okay, placed on the lips of Yahweh, God, and the speaking voice is therefore that of God and not of the prophet. I think it's important to remember that. Yeah? And there is within this text a disclosure of the heart of God. An emphasis on the interiority, that is what is actually happening within God's being, and what is being expressed is powerful emotion. Very powerful emotion expressed in God's I voice. And so therefore, every reader and preacher, if engaging in an active reading of this text, will have to bring both our cognitive and our emotional senses to bear on this text. And to fully appreciate the impact of this text, therefore, you have to arrive at a balanced reading, one that will integrate both the emotional and the cognitive.
There is a danger, perhaps, of getting a bit saccharine and sentimental about the imagery. I think the imagery of the lion roaring, the parent roaring, perhaps it mitigates that. But there is a totally with you on that balanced reading, but particularly also to avoid the sort of sentimentalization of the imagery that can happen as well. I was going to say that part of the emotion in God that we read here is also towards the end of the passage set a deep conflict within God's self that is incredibly confronting if you really take it seriously and you think, wow, this is a situation where God actually is so conflicted that doesn't know which way to turn, and that's not how we normally image God.
We would assume that God is all-knowing, God is all-purposeful, God knows, you know, what is to be, what has happened, what is going to happen. And yet you see here a very anthropomorphic representation of God, who experiences the kinds of conflict, the emotion, the grief, the wrestling, as it were, that happens inside a parent while caring for a child. And so in a way, the text gives expression to this divine pathos, expressed through God's voice and God's speaking, and the language is extremely tender, and as you say, could lead one to become all sentimental about it, but at the same time, I think if you look at the Jewish Publication Society translation of this particular text, it reads that God fell in love with Israel. Okay, when Israel was still a child, that God pampered Ephraim, and taking them in my arms. And so therefore, as you have mentioned before, there is an intimacy, and hence the some people thinking of it more of as a maternal image rather than a parental or a fatherly, a fatherly image. But the I voice reflects the intimate, loving, and compassionate relationship with Israel, and as a parent who looks back on the child's upbringing, the history of Israel's waywardness is here recalled.
Yeah, from chapter 5.
All the way back.
And it's almost, I mean, if you remember the third child mentioned in the reading last week, I forget the Hebrew name, Monica, but meaning not my people.
Yeah.
That's sort of alluded to in verse 5 onwards here, that they'll return to Egypt. This is a threat that God presents, or threatening option that God presents, in contrast to the possibility of reconciliation and restoration.
Yeah, and unfortunately, to each of God's acts, act of loving, all the acts of loving, calling from Egypt, caring for Israel, Israel has always responded with rebellion and rejection, and so in verses 5 onwards, you have. From verses 5 onwards, and particularly in verse 6, you have a narration of the outcome of their rebellion, or their refusal to repent. In other words, they are not returning to God. They are not returning to God, and they did not exalt God as the Most High in verse 7. If we can move on to verse 8, which I think is a really crucial verse in this text.
How can I give you up, Ephraim?
Yes. Yeah, so you have four escalating cries of emotion here with the use of the interrogative, how, okay, and we are, these are often seen as rhetorical questions, but these questions actually give us insight into the inner life of God and to grasp also the kind of struggle that God is experiencing. And so these questions, in fact, highlight the remarkable disclosure of the interior dynamics of divine life, according to one particular Old Testament scholar.
And in the larger story of Hosea, it can appear like, Hosea pulls absolutely no punches about what's gone on and what will befall Israel. And we've heard it through the dramatic and confronting imagery of children with terrible names and the image of prostitution and adultery and so on. It does sort of, at first blush, when you read chapter 11, seem as if, oh, well, it's all going to be all right, which isn't, I mean, a very glib take on it, but actually that's what it looks like on a superficial reading. But we also know, as you've alluded to in the history as the background here, that an awful lot of people have died. In this restoration that's happened here, there is actually also inevitably a lot of suffering and people who've been left behind. So the question of, is everything all right now? The question then is, well, for whom is it all right? Yeah. And I think we can get a bit lost in the sort of anthropocentric focus there. What the good news, if I might use that phrase here, for me is what this says about God, that God will remain, yes, faithful, but involved in the recalcitrance of this people. That God will. God has. Yeah. Despite the internal conflict and the fragmentation that is happening for God here, the good news of Hosea is that God will remain nonetheless in this adventure and for this people.
Yeah, and the punishment that the people experience, of course, comes from the hand of God. But this doesn't mean that God stands apart from the pain that did cause,
no,
that it causes,
yeah,
people. And so, in a way, God embraces the pain within God's self, within God's own person. I mean, one can also make reference to Jesus Christ and the crucifixion. You know, the embracing of the pain of the people. Through the questioning highlights this wrestling that happens within God, and the questions are retrospective, since God does not yet know the answers, and hence they are not merely rhetorical questions, but a genuine probing of God, where God is wrestling with God's self, as I've said already. So God's heart is actually recoiling within God's self. How can I do this? But I have to do it. How can I bring these people back to the good ways for which they have been created, And so God's compassion is aroused. If you look at the last part of verse 8, you know, the arousal of God's heart, it is grown hot within God. So can you imagine something inside of you that has gotten really hot, that it makes you feel uncomfortable and therefore is causing here extreme pain within God's self, and God has to embrace that pain.
One of the big picture ways of looking at this is starting to think, well, what's Israel's sin here? Well, we've named it, you know, it's adultery, it's having an idol, etc., etc. But really, in this incredibly intimate imagery of the parent and the child, and God's remembering of God's history with the people as a child, and so on. What really Israel has failed to do is to embrace, accept, be in that intimate relationship. That is the sin, yep. Is to not accept themselves as God's people, and as we do in their hospitality, we do the same. But that's a very different way for me anyway to think about, for want of a better word, sin. It's much more thoroughgoing. But it's not alienating to say that the sin is not to accept what's given to you in front of you. You know, this is your relationship with God.
Yeah.
Live and be in it.
Right. And to acknowledge, you know, that you are what you are. You are where you are because of God, you know, and God's involvement in your life. And so if we can move on to Psalm 107, yes, where you have a listing of all the steadfast things or steadfast expressions of God's steadfast love for the community, for the nation. The psalmist is sending out a call to people to recognize what God has done and to be thankful to God. So it's a call to acknowledge and to thank the divine for what God has done, and therefore the psalm you know in the reading ends with that verse 43, which says anyone who is wise will heed these things. In other words, will recognize what God has done, the way in which God has fed, has nurtured, has protected you, has offered of himself to the community for the well-being of the community, and you know, all expressions of God's unfailing love.
Yeah, the steadfast love, that's echoing term that is the key in Hosea as well, and is clearly behind the chapter 11's imagery.
Yes.
So that brings us to the gospel reading for this week, Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21, though there might be an argument, folks, I think, to include verses 22 to 34, which would make it a long reading, but those ones about not worrying and so on. Mm-hmm. It might be helpful to add that section as well. So this is a tricky part of Luke's gospel around chapters 11 and 12, tricky for modern ears anyway. There's a lot of stuff about judgment and the end time and the impending coming and the urgency and so on. And there's a lot of controversies and warnings, critique of the Pharisees and the lawyers, stuff about fear and security, which is what emerges in this passage from the rich man.
I think for me, what the text is calling for is a recognition of greed amongst people or amongst communities, and how and so here Jesus is actually responding to the attitude to this attitude, you know, greediness. And it's interesting that two brothers come to Jesus and ask this question, and they know what Jesus stands for, ideologically speaking, because he's said so, you know, in all his public speaking.
And they've called him teacher.
Yes, and they come to him asking him to give them advice on how one should decide about money, you know, knowing what he thinks about it. In a way, it's great that because they recognize him as a teacher, they are willing to perhaps change or are open to being, you know, suggestions about how we should treat wealth within the community. And I think their question is very pertinent today when you think of how status is measured in our communities based on wealth. And so here, Jesus, who is known for his arguments for justice, who is known for the imperatives that he has articulated in terms of taking care of the poor, the boys perhaps knew what Jesus was going to say, but they really needed to hear it from him once again, because he's recognized as a wise teacher. And Jesus uses the parable of the rich fool as an illustration because Jesus is asked to settle an argument over money. So the parable, I don't know what you think it's about, Fran, but I think it's about good stewardship. But one can see more. But let me.
Well, yes, first. I mean, I was on a sort of more superficial level. He sounds very wise from the point of view of the sort of advice we all get about living a responsible life, which is make sure you've got a good superannuation company and that you're paying adequate super. And then often there's issues if you've been a primary carer of children and you haven't worked as much that you need to make up your super. I mean, the whole narrative of our world is contrary to what's going on here. But it's not so much, again, with these stories about wealth and money, it's not so much that it's a terrible thing in and of itself, because you might argue that throwing all caution to the wind and not having superannuation and not thinking about your future is foolish in terms of your responsibility to your family now. It's really about putting all your focus, all your expectation of salvation or security in that stuff, mm-hmm. in the money. So as you say, it's really about stewardship or discernment and focus.
Yeah, it I think the text is also about the fact that the rich man is not stocking up to provide for his family or his household or his community or the welfare of the community. No, he is stocking up so that he can have an easy life.
Yeah, and
okay, so that he
and party.
Not, yeah, he can party. He need not work any longer. So, in a sense, his motives are purely individualistic,
selfish. Yeah,
and selfish. And so, it's a focus on greed and also laziness.
And it's contrary, to the commandment, the summary of the main commandment, to love God and your neighbour. There's no, that the presence of that is not there for this man.
No, it is not. So, so I guess what the parable is critiquing is anyone's obsession with accumulating wealth. And I think we need to be clear here that, we all are worried about the future and we do want to make sure that, that we are comfortable and parents and individuals set aside money, save money for the sake of the future that is required of us. But here it is an obsession, okay? It is an obsession with material goods, and the parable seems to allude to the fact that material goods take predominance over the value of God.
Yeah. And I'm reminded of a couple of other stories in Luke where this has been his focus on what's distracted us from the main thing. So a few weeks ago we focused on the story of Mary and Martha, and no, it's not about some binary separation between the contemplative and the active life, but actually that Mary's fault, or I don't know about using that word, but is that she became distracted from the focus on hospitality of this one before them, this Jesus, and put Jesus on the spot as guest, actually, and started getting at Martha for not helping. Getting at Mary for not helping. So there was a distraction in that story. Here it's not many things that are distracting the rich man, but on the fixation on additional resources.
Yeah. And so this is, I mean, he this rich man was storing up riches for earthly use and neglecting the spirit, as it were, and this can only lead to misery and distress. So there's a warning that Jesus is issuing through this parable. And I guess the gospel also resonates with what the Colossian text is saying. And Paul's advice to the Colossians also rings true today. That is to set our hearts on heavenly things, you know. And in order to set our hearts on heavenly things and not be overly obsessed with the world in which we live and, you know, because doing that means we might lose ourselves, we might lose our souls.
Yeah, well, in Colossians chapter 3, verse 4, when Christ, who is your life, is revealed, so that, yeah, that focus isn't on all that other stuff, but actually on Christ, who is not just a companion or someone wise to follow, but actually the locus of your life. Then you will be revealed in glory. So it's very much a commentary, I think, this epistle, particular passage on the gospel.
On the gospel. And I think it's important to also acknowledge that how we live our lives also testify to the God we believe in.
Yes.
Okay. So if Christ is within you, then your actions will indicate, will show forth, you know, we need to show forth Christ in our actions. So, you know, in a way, our beliefs about the God we profess to be God are enacted.
There's a continuity. There must be a continuity, which is something that Hosea was on to Israel about. I can't help thinking a great sermon title or theme for this week would be what is it to be rich towards God, and what does each of the readings, you know, this is the, it's the phrase in verse 21 here, what does each of the readings have to say about that? And I think we've heard from Hosea, to be rich towards God is to recognize one's sonship and daughtership of God and the intimacy and the great gift of that intimacy and the calling that that then has upon us. And what does it mean here in Luke? Well, it's not that we go around beating ourselves up so that we do stuff and live life in service, because that's, you know, and get rid of all our stuff. I mean, that's law. But to be rich towards God is to place one's hope for salvation and security in this faithful God and not in the material things around us, or indeed that we give thanks for those material things as coming from God and not as things of our own devising.
Yeah, and I think there's a caution here about accumulating more than what we need, and how we go about accumulating that wealth. You know, who have you inconvenienced, or who have you hurt? Who have you deprived? You know,
yes.
In the process of accumulating. So in a sense, it's, I would like to take this beyond the individual
absolutely.
To the community as well, or to the nation, to see what are the structures we have put in place to ensure this equal distribution of wealth, giving people equal opportunity to show wealth. Not for, you know, for their well-being and the well-being of their families and their
stewardship,
stewardship of the resources that this nation has. I think for me another idea in terms of sermon would also be this emphasis on compassion and God's steadfast love that you see, I think, is a theme that kind of links all these four readings together. And how can we emulate God in developing a compassionate stance to the suffering that we see around us? And I think today on Facebook there was a quote by someone who said he thought that kindness was the best word, that it encapsulates everything that a human being is called to do. And so it's love, it's compassion, it's mercy. I don't know, you can add to that.
Yeah, list, but I mean, the gospel truth too is that we fall short of that all the time. And yes, we live in response to God in that way with God's help. But I suppose the good news for me is that when we fail, and we will and we do and we are, God is there lifting us up to God's cheek and giving us charge to start again, clothed in a new self, in the words of Colossians. So I think that's all for this week.
Yes.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.